Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm Charles Bromesco.
And I'm Adam Woodward.
And today we'll be talking about the octogenarian Oscar-winning dementia drama The Father, the anxiety-inducing waking nightmare that is Shiver Baby, and in Film Club we celebrate 25 years, oh yeah, since the release of the Coen Brothers' darkly comic crime classic Fargo. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome listeners to another episode of Truth and Movies. I'm so thrilled today to be joined by Charles Bromesco and Adam Woodward, both first-timers since the revamp. So what we like to do is to ask people to reintroduce themselves and where they sit within the Little White Lies empire. Adam, who are you and what do you do?
Oh my goodness, what a question. I am the digital editor at Little White Lies, so I kind of oversee everything that that encompasses. Including this pod, which really pleased to see it kind of, you know, surviving the Panny D and back, I think, hopefully stronger than ever.
Absolutely. And this is our first transatlantic episode of the podcast since we've relaunched. So Charles, you are based in Brooklyn.
That's right, New York City, baby. Very exciting to be on the podcast, coming to you from the new world, as it were.
Yes. What do you bring to the Little White Lies recipe?
So I believe my technical title is news editor. On a day-to-day basis, I'm keeping an eye on developments and trailers and other fun sort of day-to-day business and giving those little write-ups on the site as well as, you know, the occasional review and feature, all around critiquing.
So it's, for the last couple of episodes, we've been asking, you know, about cinema trips, because in the UK, cinemas have just reopened after the lockdown. How's stuff going in the States? Have you been going to drive-ins? Have you been going to the cinema yet?
So regrettably, I mean, I did not have much in the way of car access during the whole pandemic. And so I was mostly at home for about 14-month stretch. However, that recently changed. I went to go see... All of my firsts are coming along now. I saw my first proper film in the theater with people. I saw Spiral from the Book of Saw, which was very sparsely attended, though I could not tell whether that was a function of the pandemic or just a day at the movies. I did my first press screening in one of the big cinemas. They showed us in the Heights at one of the multiplexes, which was lovely. And I did my first tiny screening room screening as well. I saw Zola last week, which I was extremely taken with. And so it does feel... at least like I am back in the swing of things. I don't think we're back at full capacity yet, or at least I hope not. But yeah, things are, life is resuming in a very heartening way.
Yeah, the whole smorgasbord of cinema screenings coming back to you. We should say, listeners, the new issue of Little White Lies is still on shelves wherever you get your magazines. You can also get it from lwlies.com, a beautiful issue all about First Cow, which we discussed on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. You know, Charles, you're talking about the whole landscape of cinema reopening again, and this week we're talking about two very locked-in, closed-down films. So we should probably kick off with that chat, very contrary to the mood of reopening, with our first film this week, which is The Father. In The Father, Anthony Hopkins plays the eponymous role of a mischievous and highly independent man who, as he ages, refuses all assistance from his daughter Anne, played by Olivia Colman. Yet such help has become essential following Anne's decision to move to Paris with her partner. As Anne's father tries to make sense of his changing circumstances, he begins to doubt his loved ones, his own mind, and even the fabric of his reality. So this is one of those films that premiered early in the year in 2020, took a while to come out, picked up awards hype, picked up Oscars, and now it's finally making it out to UK cinemas. The big one, of course, being Anthony Hopkins winning an Oscar for Best Actor for this. Adam, do you think that is deserved?
Yeah, it's interesting you're talking about the journey the film's been on so far, and it almost sounds strange to call this a sleeper hit, given the cast and, you know, the kind of, the awards attention it's received, but it does feel like it's been a bit of a slow burn. And maybe understandably so. I think this could be on paper a film that would maybe be targeted at an older audience and kind of going for that grey pound. But I think actually it is a really like universal film, and the story is, you know, certainly if you're of a certain age, you maybe have an elderly relative or you know someone who has gone through this kind of experience. So I think it's like extremely relatable. And much of that does come through Hopkins' performance, but I think the writing also. But yeah, I mean, what Hopkins does is just, you know, I think, especially at his kind of vintage, to kind of find this performance or to kind of channel this, what must be a quite kind of, you know, raw, it's something that I think for him, you know, as a guy who is coming towards the end of his career, let's be honest, I mean, hopefully he's got many years left in him, but I think this, to actually kind of go there with this performance and you know, I won't kind of give anything away with regards to the ending, but you know, if you see maybe the trailer or any of the publicity materials for this film, it doesn't really, I think, convey the extent to which Hopkins does go there. Mm-hmm. And it's just a really, I think, really beautiful, really brave performance. So yeah, I think he deserves every award going for this.
It really makes me think about, there's one poster in particular where it's Anthony Hopkins with a little glint in his eye, a bit of mischief, with Olivia Colman with a hand on his shoulder. And it really could be, as you say, Adam, Grey Pound. Charles, I'm not sure if we have Grey Pound films in the States.
No, I understand exactly what you mean, the grey dollar. Yeah, same concept.
But how would you describe this film and what it does? Because Florian Zeller adapting this from a stage play to the big screen. It's very much a single location thing in this flat, very much from his psychological point of view. But what does he do with that?
That's where I was really surprised and impressed, because I was sort of, I guess, dreading a Still Alice type experience in which we're really made to painstakingly watch the cognizance leave the eyes of this person, which is obviously a very difficult thing to watch in a movie, exponentially more so in real life. But what's very clever is that this is really the only depiction of Alzheimer's senility that I've seen that really comes from within that psychological vantage point. There are a lot of tricks with staging and with the elapsing of time that put us in the place of Anthony Hopkins and disorient us in the same way that he's disoriented. And so I think doing that allows them to sort of forestall the really pulverizingly sad parts until the end, which you had mentioned obliquely. But during most of it, it is not so much of the misery which is felt by the people caring for him, but what we feel is his experience, which is frustration mostly, and confusion and irritation, which I think is both true to life and a really great way to get around that sort of sedate feeling that can often come with one of these, you know, family movies.
Mm. It's really interesting how recently dementia or old age themes like that has become a fertile ground for filmmakers. Relic, of course, also came out last year, and that took a much more horror movie, haunted house almost, approach to the genre, to the idea, to the experience. Whereas this very much is using the uncanny space and the sense of dislocation within a space that you're meant to feel at home in to get us to the root of the psychology. Adam, would you draw any other comparisons with The Father with other films that people may have seen?
Yeah, I think the thing that immediately came to mind for me was Michael Haneke's Amour, which I actually saw in Cannes whenever that was, I think maybe 2012 or something.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
Going back a few years, but that was one of those films that I think you know, struck a chord certainly with everyone who attended the festival and everyone I spoke to at the time. And, you know, I don't think there was like a dry eye in the house for that screening. And it was a film that I think, you know, people kind of respected and also said, I quite happily never watched that film again. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe The Father falls in that same camp.
I think,
you know, I do think on a technical level, I think Charles just touched on this, but on a technical level, I think this does something quite similar to Amour in some ways, in that you've got this single, very contained setting, and there's scenes that do kind of blur the line a little bit between not so much reality and fantasy, but like the perspective of the person that is kind of suffering. I mean, in the case of Amour, it's more like grief and loss as opposed to just like Alzheimer's. But, you know, there'll be scenes in The Father where Anthony Hopkins is having a conversation with someone. The camera kind of tracks through the flat, and they leave, and then he carries on, you know, goes to the kitchen, and suddenly there's a knock at the door, and you realize that like within that space, even though there's not been a cut, maybe as many as like several days or even longer have elapsed. And I think that's something which, you know, is very true of the disease from everything I understand about it. And my gran actually has dementia, and it's not quite as far gone as Anthony Hopkins' character in this, but one of the things that's really striking when you spend any time with her is like that sense of how much she's, you know, kind of living in her own world, I think would be the way to put it. You know, the idea of like the way it not only affects your short-term memory, but your perception of the rest of the world around you, basically, and the way that time kind of goes on. I think, you know, so many of us live our lives by the clock, right? We're always kind of, you know, keeping an eye on the time, and everything kind of revolves around this cycle. But I think when that's broken, and when you kind of lose your kind of grounding in that, then it becomes really difficult. And I think another thing this film does really well actually shows how difficult it is for the people around the person. So although you've got these really sympathetic, really, really empathetic characters like Olivia Colman and Olivia Williams as well in this, who I think is really good. You also get characters who are maybe less sympathetic towards Hopkins' character, and you get this anger and this frustration and this cruelty as well coming out, which it's really difficult. But again, I think quite a brave move on the part of the film and Florian Zeller to show that as well.
Yeah, a much sharper and more troubling film perhaps than you may expect. This was a funny old year for awards discourse anyway, but since this was released is coming out in the UK so late compared to some of the other maybe fan favourites that were in contention, it felt like almost a safer option as a winner. You know, of course Anthony Hopkins will take Best Actor, but I think there's something of real quality here, and something that we shouldn't really spoil as much as, you know, as we, you know, we should try not to spoil, because it's really is an experience like a play, which you should just go and give it the time, sit through, almost a perfect cinema movie in that sense, after, you know, browsing through our phone, watching films on TV for the last year. Charles, before we put any scores on, anything else you can sort of tease about The Father without giving too much away?
Yeah, I think that if you are someone who watches film with a mind towards nuts and bolts acting, you will find that his performance is so rich in detail and specificity. And I guess part of that is influenced. My grandfather passed away a few years ago by the same thing, and a lot of his little fixations, he was always checking his pocket for his change. He always had change in his breast pocket, and he was always making sure that was still there, much in the same way that Anthony Hopkins often, like you were saying, he kind of grounds himself by finding his watch. In the same way he gets hung up on certain phrases, he has his little joke about how you can't move to France, they don't even speak English there. Which is fun. I found out, you know, this is a French play, and I wonder, in the original, is it that a Parisian is moving to London, and you can't move to London, they don't even speak French there. I just mean to say that this is a performance really rich and lived in detail, both in the writing and in the way that Anthony Hopkins approaches it. I was hugely impressed, and I think it's a risky performance in many ways, which is not something that we always associate with someone whose greatness is as firmly understood as Anthony Hopkins, but he's still, you know, it's a lively, spontaneous performance from someone who's, you know, really getting on in years, which just makes it all the more impressive.
Yeah. much to recommend, I think, about The Father. And yeah, that's a really fascinating aspect. I think it had already been adapted into a French film, which looks much more French sort of knockabout comedy with a quirky dad, if you go and look up that version. But let's put some scores on The Father. Adam, I'll come to you first. So we go in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect.
I think in anticipation, I don't really know too much about it going in. I hadn't seen the play or seen the French film, which you just mentioned. So I'd maybe say a 3. And I would say maybe partly that's based on the fact that Anthony Hopkins, gladly having proven me wrong now, but I'd kind of thought maybe his best days were behind him as well. Enjoyment, I'd say 4, mostly based on his performance. But I think, as we've said, the writing is just so rich and there's so much to it. I think in retrospect, it's really tricky with this because it's a film I've thought about a lot, but a film I have no plans to revisit anytime soon. So I'd maybe go 4 again for that.
And Charles?
I have to say, I think I'm going to reiterate a lot of what you said there. I approached this not really with anticipation so much as dread. I thought this is going to be a really difficult watch. And so I would say probably 2 or even 3. Just, I had heard that the reviews were positive, but this really did not seem like it would be to my liking. But watching it, yeah, I was really surprised by how it moves along. Rather short film that really moves right along. And so, yeah, I would say 4 as well for enjoyment. In retrospect, I feel pretty secure about saying 5. This is something that I have been dwelling on a lot. Not only Anthony Hopkins' performance, I think we see a lot of fine films that are really built from the performance outward, but I think formally, creatively, the way it's conceived and executed, I think it's really just a strong piece of work, especially from someone who's really just dipping his toe into the world of film now. This is his first feature. So I would give him the 5 on this one. I'd say he's earned it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree. In retrospect, this was a 5 for me. In terms of anticipation, there's a great pedigree behind this, even though, as you say, Florence Zeller is, hasn't worked in film before, is translating a play from a foreign language. He's working with Christopher Hampton, who you go back through his career as a dramatist and a screenwriter, adapter of stage plays from Dangerous Liaisons onwards, has some pedigree behind him. And what a cast. But if there was any trepidation, that was sort of blown out almost immediately. A really sharp film that does linger in the mind. So I think for me it's 4, 4, 5. I'm not very confident with that. So we're going to leave behind The Father and go and shack up with our sugar daddy next for Shiver Baby.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast. Alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
College student Danielle is faced with a series of awkward encounters at a day-long shiver, a Jewish gathering during a time of mourning. Amongst overbearing relatives, she is rattled by the appearance of an ex-girlfriend and her secret sugar daddy, who unexpectedly arrives with his wife and baby. So, Charles, can you introduce us to the world of Shiver Baby here? That's quite an enclosed, quite low budget, but it's been getting quite a bit of hype.
Yeah, this is a film that I think won a lot of people over for the accuracy with which it portrays an incredibly a lifelike milieu. This is a young millennial Jewish woman, which is, I think, in my coverage of the film for its U.S. release a little while ago, I talked about how a lot of the characteristics that we once associated with specifically being Jewish have sort of started to apply to millennials at large. All of these neuroses, anxieties about your job, fraught relationships with your parents, I think these have become more common. But we see all of those things really crank to 11 when Danielle is made to attend a shiva, which is a funeral ritual. After a Jew dies, you sit with their family and loved ones and you do a lot of noshing, that is to say eating, and you do a lot of kvetching, which is to say complaining, all these fun Yiddish terms that we're going to pick up today. And so, yeah, she's there. And what is really agonizing about this is that for Danielle, who I believe is 20 in the film, she is one of a grand total of two young people at this party. She is subjected to really a battery of invasive, insulting, passive-aggressive questioning from all of these old women and her mother's friends. And the only person that she really has there as a lifeline is her ex, which makes matters even more complicated, whose name is Maya, that they went to prom together and shared a formative sexual experience, but they are currently somewhat on the outs, sort of miscommunications via social media, have slightly estranged them from one another, but there's definitely still something there. And so, yeah, a lot of plates spinning in the air, and it is all the more impressive for the way that it fits right into her portrait of this lifestyle, I guess you could call it, because it's not even about Judaism, but a very specific strain of really niggling, insecurity breeding Jewish parenting and Jewish family units.
Hmm. You know, as you say, Charles, it is actually fascinating how many of the qualities we associate with the millennial experience can almost be borrowed over from elements of sort of Jewish observational humor and family humor.
I think a lot of the comedy of the past century, you know, has been informed by Jews and the Jewish sensibility, and so that's sort of been absorbed at large.
Mm. But then, so if it is sort of part of this wave of millennial angst, we see that in independent films, we're seeing it on TV as well, BBC series like, you know, Starstruck, certain extent Fleabag, things like that. What is this doing differently to make it stand out from the crowd, if anything?
So I guess it's the way that it's applied. Like, it's we meet Danielle early on, and she seems, we meet her in a rather compromising position with her sugar daddy. She has a lovely interaction where they get to it. He writes her a little, or I think he, I don't know if it's cash or a check, but he pays her, she goes on her merry way, and then to her horror, she encounters him at the shiva. And so I think it is not just sort of pinpointing this personality and articulating it this way, but then inserting it into this pressure cooker environment where the anxiety she already has is just like ratcheted up constantly, little by little. All of these embarrassing, compromising things keep happening and shattering really the one sort of a solace she had, which was her relationship with this guy, which has now begun to come crashing down.
So Adam, what's your take on Shiva Baby? So this has kind of been positioned as a breakout for both the writer-director Emma Seligman, but also the lead Rachel Sennett, who sort of had a bit of social media fame based on her videos posting on social media. So what's your take on Shiva Baby?
Yeah, I must say, Rachel Sennett was not on my radar at all. I understand she is kind of quite a big persona on Twitter especially, but I think she's really good in this actually. You know, she gets that kind of awkwardness, anxiety. I love the fact her character is kind of railing against her situation, her parents, but also very much aware that she is kind of like, you know, she hasn't really severed that cord yet. So she kind of does, you know, she does kind of have to kind of keep these plates spinning, and it's very much like a millennial, almost like a comedy of manners, I'd describe it a little bit, although, you know, the manners are very much being kind of you know, she's I guess Rachel Sennett's character is trying to her best to kind of break them down, but also, yeah, very much reliant on these just the whole, as you said, Charles, the kind of dynamic in this Jewish family, and she's very aware of like where the power is, I guess, and where the power balance is. Mm. But yeah, she's really good in this. I think just very funny, very witty, very dry. There's very like sardonic kind of almost black streak of humor through this. And I think in terms of Emma Seligman's role in this, I think as well as the writing being really sharp and well observed, I think just directorially, it's really interesting. I think formally she goes to some interesting places with it, and there's a kind of sequence at the end which is quite kind of fever dreamish, and everything gets kind of cranked up. And there's a bit with a baby, which actually oddly enough kind of reminded me of Darren Aronofsky's Mother. Gets very intense very quickly, and everything feels like it's kind of closing in on her, and suddenly these kind of fairly abstract you know, bodies in the room at this shiver, it feels like they're kind of like walling her in, and she's kind of shouldering her way through the crowd a little bit. And yeah, I think it's really, really clever from a kind of technical point of view in terms of using that space and the way the actors are blocked and the way that they kind of all lock together and interact.
Yeah, it's quite a sort of almost pot-boiling sort of thing, where the constant assault of questions and assumptions and about your life and your direction and all your family neuroses being projected onto you. It makes me think of something that Hannah Strong of this parish mentioned in relation to Uncut Gems, where some people see that as incredibly stressful, but to some people, that's just life. Charles, did you see this as an existential horror movie or just very painfully well observed?
Yeah, I think it is. It is many things to many people. The aspect that I feel like we haven't really touched on yet, which I think goes hand in hand with the aspect of this as horror, as tension, but it is. I found it hysterically funny. A lot of just wonderful one-liners delivered really with great commitment, with great aplomb by Rachel Sennett. I think it's one of the better and more merciless depictions of approaching the end of college without anything really planned. I think she's getting needled about her job prospects, and she says, and this is perfect, she says, it's not a career, it's a lens, which is about the way she's studying. My point being that I think the agony and comedy of this are two sides of the exact same coin. I think when you watch someone's parents cut down their self-esteem, which almost always happens in a way that is funny, I think we see this happen in a way that is well-intended and thus comedic more than just outright abusive. I see that much more frequently. And so when we see this, it is funny to us, obviously, because it's not happening to us, but it is also painful because we can very easily imagine it happening to us or remember a time when it did happen to us. And so I definitely get the idea of this as a sort of overwhelming sensory experience in the way of Uncut Gems, which comes down to a lot of the sound design, which is incredibly layered, really cluttered, really, really chaotic. The soundtrack has all these splintering, cracking string noises that feel like you're pulling a splinter out of your ear. And so I think, yeah, it is definitely a sort of intense experience in that way, but also very funny, very watchable. And I think like 81 minutes at a also very fleet film, which I respect, especially from someone adapting. It was a short film. She had created a short film with Rachel Sennett around this. And I often find that when a director adapts their own short film, you can always pick out what selection of the movie the short was and then how it's built around. I think that's very naturally integrated in this case, that you can't really figure out what was your idea and then you had a bunch of tertiary ideas around it. It really feels like one cohesive film.
Yeah, you're right to point out the length. I think this is one of those rare episodes of Truth in Movies where all three films are quite short. I think you watch all three films we're talking about this week in the space that you'd take to watch the Snyder Cut. So which one I'd recommend doing. But let's put some scores on this film, on Shiver Baby. Charles, I'll come to you first.
I think in many respects of demographic, I am perhaps the ideal audience for this film. And so once I really knew what it was about and who was involved, you know, also Rachel Sennett, if she's big anywhere, it's here in Brooklyn. This is where she does her shows and where she has sort of created a following. So I was curious about all this. I'll say 4. There was a lot of talent attached that had really piqued my interest. And then I would say in terms of enjoyment, that's a solid 5 for me. This is one of my favorite films of the year. I thought it was so quotable, so well observed, so funny, so disturbing and unsettling. And then ultimately by the end, very sweet. The way it ends, which is on a sort of subtle note, really leaves you on a very kind of touching note, which I hadn't expected. So that's definitely a 5. And in retrospect, I feel secure that it was a 5. This came out in the States now a few months ago, so I've had the benefit of some real life hindsight, and I'm still as attached to it as I was upon my first viewing.
Adam, what are your scores for Shiver Baby?
Yeah, I'm wavering a little bit. I think Charles has kind of quite compelled me with his scores there. But as I say, neither the director or star really were on my radar before. So I'd go 3 for anticipation. I think a solid 4 for enjoyment. Just really, really like the kind of cut of this film's jib. I would say I'm kind of wavering between a 3 and a 4 in retrospect. I think the cynic in me wanted a less cozy ending, although I do see why, I think the way it ends is actually very fitting and very, very sweet, as Charles said. But yeah, I'm going to kind of sit on the fence there and say like a 3.5 in retrospect. But I definitely would I would anticipate their next work very, very highly.
Absolutely. I think I'd place this in a similar estimation to Troy Schultz's Krisha, a sort of first feature, very enclosed, very close to home, really powerful in its own way, but you just want to see what they're doing next. So it might go up on a second viewing. I will say I watched this after taking my first jab of the vaccination, so it's feeling a little bit weird. So I'll say 3-3-3, but there's certainly plenty of talent here, not least a nice cameo from the always welcome Fred Melamed.
It is a character actor bonanza. There are a lot of really, really great bit players in there. Jackie Hoffman, who is a legend in New York, is one of the old women. It's always giving her a hard time. It's a lot of fun people to spot.
It sounds like, Charles, we should do rewatch it with you giving us a commentary.
Jews commentary. Jewish one.
Fantastic. That's Shiver Baby, which has one-off screenings up and down the country this week, but is on Mubi this weekend as well to watch. So up next, we have Film Club, going all the way back to 1996 for the Coen brothers' Fargo. If you haven't seen Fargo before, here's a nice blurb. A reality-based crime drama set in Minnesota in 1987. Jerry Lundegaard is a car salesman in Minneapolis who's gotten himself into debt and is so desperate for money that he hires 2 thugs, Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare, to kidnap his own wife. Jerry will collect the ransom from her wealthy father, paying the thugs a small portion and keeping the rest to satisfy his debts. The scheme collapses when the thugs shoot a state trooper. So this is, at the time it was seen as one of the Coen brothers' great breakouts, but now it's almost, it's 25 years ago, it's early Coens. Adam, where does Fargo land for you? What's your take on it, particularly rewatching it?
Yeah, actually, this was a very well timed rewatch because I was kind of left with a gaping void with Mayor of Easttown finishing, so this was kind of perfect spot for Monday night following that show ending. And actually, I've been reading a lot about Mayor of Easttown and people kind of talking about this kind of seemingly new subgenre of like women crime dramas and kind of tracing it back to things like Gone Girl. But I actually think Fargo is a really interesting precursor to something like Mayor of Easttown. It's got humor, obviously, but I think it's a darker kind of affair all round. And I think Fargo's a little bit softer, although it has these moments of is punctuated by some quite intense violence. But it's just a really comforting film in a weird way. I don't know how else to describe it, really. And I have that thing with the Coen brothers where, if you ask me to name my favorite of their films, it's probably the last one I watched. So, it is just so airtight, I think, this film. As we've said, it's very economic with its runtime. I love the fact, and I always kind of forget this until I rewatch it, but I love the fact that you're not introduced to the main character until about 20 minutes in or something, which actually, it's a fairly unconventional, unusual thing to have that in a film of this nature. And I think the way, obviously Frances McDormand's performance elevates this so much, but the way that you're introduced to the character and her story being kind of bookended by these very sweet, quite intimate moments with her and her husband Norm in bed, just kind of, in their own very private little space, is just so beautiful. I love the fact that they do that, because it's kind of, it does drive the plot forward a little bit, but it's just really really kind of insignificant, trivial detail, I suppose. It's something which a lot of directors would not even think to add, basically, but it really, really rounds out the character and kind of, you know, just gives you so much in terms of her life and her backstory, mm-hmm. which you'd otherwise maybe not get from a film like this. So, yeah, I think her performance especially is what makes this so good. And it's a really different performance to maybe what we're more used to nowadays with things like Three Billboards and Nomadland. But yeah, she is superb in this.
It is definitely a film to watch now, thinking about all of the various paths the people behind and in front of the camera have been on. You know, Frances McDormand, you know, it's relevant now because of Nomadland, but it feels like she's settled into more of a screen persona, which is Frances McDormand doing these roles. Whereas when she's Marge Gunderson, she's very much buried into that performance and has those little wonderful quirks in the screenplay and the performance, the accents and all that. We should nod to Claire Vaughan on Twitter, who tweeted saying Marge's husband is one of the best examples of non-toxic masculinity in the movies. And I think about their lovely relationship all the time. Absolutely true. I love that it ends on them as well. Charles, where does Fargo land for you in the Coen brothers' filmography?
The phrase non-toxic masculinity has always sounded a bit like a shampoo brand to me. That's not my take on the film. That's just the last thought I had. I think that when I was first getting acquainted with cinephilia, Fargo was really the consensus pick for greatest Coen brothers of all time. And I think having seen the rest of their films now, it's sort of clear why that is. It's definitely, I think, the most lovable and approachable Coen brothers movie. I think despite not being an outright comedy, it is one of their funniest. And I think it is built around a very legible and comprehensible idea, which is like, what if it was a film noir set in a place that was blanketed entirely in white? That's really how I look at it, where you see films like Barton Fink or Man Who Wasn't There, which I think are really for the real heads, as they say, which are have a sort of greater opacity and don't really invite you in as much as Fargo does, which it really, really does. I find it to be not only like so fiendishly clever and well-conceived, I think it is just a really enjoyable film. It's full of lines that make me laugh. Steve Buscemi's great performance. This would be, I would say, top three for me, up there with Oh Brother and Serious Man. That's my top three right there.
I mean, Serious Man would be a great double bill with Shiva Baby, I think.
Yes, absolutely. Fred Melamed double feature, baby.
Mm-hmm. But for me, that's really fascinating. Adam, this is something we talk about quite a lot in these film clubs. There's that moment in the mid-90s where if you were an American filmmaker worth your salt, you sort of attracted some stylistic elements that you could almost call post-Tarantino. We talked about Lost Highway being that for David Lynch. I think we mentioned Hard Eight being that for PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson. And this is one where I don't think the Coens ever have this approach to violence, certainly not guns blazing violence ever again. Maybe you could see some of that. It's used for comic effects in Burn After Reading, much more in a slapstick way. Maybe True Grit, you can say. But this feels very typically mid-90s to me in that sort of sense of an era of sideways look at American crime as a genre. But it's then fascinating to see that everything is there that we love about the Coens, the character details, the specificity, the brilliant character names. All the characters have just wonderful names. Charles, you mentioned the idea that it's a noir set in a landscape coated in white. And this is Roger Deakins in the many years where he should have won Oscars before he went off and made much flashier films on bigger canvases and then won Oscars.
I think that this is just ingenious work. The way I always think of this film is like it's a photo negative of a film noir. The first scene I think that we really like that captures everything is Jerry Lundegaard, who is trudging through this unforgiving, humiliating snow so that he can scrape the ice off his windshield like the puny loser that he is. And we get this incredible overhead shot of him going through a parking lot where the only things that aren't coated in snow are, I think, these garden boxes that they have little trees in. And it creates the image of him walking across a little hand-sewn needlepoint or a quilt, which is, I mean, that's so clever. And the way it's inserted is so unobtrusive. And I look back at that and I was like, wow, what a great idea he had and inserted so smoothly into the film. I think he's great. And I think what you had said about the 90s-ness, the post-Tarantino-ness, is correct. I think that there's definitely an ironic detachment to the film, which is really identified with the time that a lot of people mistook as condescension. I think the constant charge against the Coens is that they always think they're smarter and better than their characters, which is, I think, if you're any real devotee of the Coens, you can tell that that is not the case, because as much humor as there is, because these are guys from the Midwest and they understand the little goofy parts of being from the Midwest, there are also these moments of intense earnestness that we see Marge and her husband in bed, and you can see that he does definitely believe in this. And so I think visually, ethically, it all squares up.
We talked about the violence, but I think the humor, I'm not sure they've done physical comedy or visual humor better than in here. I mean, you know, I will never not laugh at the image of Steve Buscemi kind of trudging through the snow, having just kind of buried this this suitcase, which you know inevitably he's never going to find again. And, you know, there's a wonderful moment where he just kind of falls through what must be about 4 feet of snow and has to kind of pull himself out. And, you know, that was just one take that tickled them in the editing room and they decided to keep it. But I think, yeah, there's so much wonderful, very subtle visual humor going on in this.
Yeah. And that the idea of the buried suitcase of money in the snow is in that film, Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, sort of indie film. I saw it at Berlin a few years ago. It did finally come out. And it's about this Japanese lady who watches Fargo and takes it at face value when they say this is based on a real thing that happened in the 80s in Minnesota. And she thinks there's actually a hidden case of money out there and goes on a, it's quite a dark film, character study of maybe a quarter life crisis, directionless malaise. But so funny that the Coen brothers just added that at top just as a gag. Again, that's some of that ironic detachment right there, Charles.
Those kind of disclaimers based on a true story is like one of my greatest bugbears in film. I think it's like the most redundant thing ever. But this Fargo is the one film where I can make an exception to that. I think it's brilliant. It's a really funny little joke to open the film and just perfectly sets the tone for what you're about to watch, I think.
And there are a million great lines as well. I always think the one less quoted, but my favorite, is the sweaty sales pitch that Jerry Lundegaard gives to the people he's trying to build. He's, you're going to want that true coat. You never get the true coat.
It really is one of those films that every time I go back, it's all these moments. It's so just jam-packed with moments, ones you remember, ones you've forgotten. It's really worth checking out. So I'm not a TV guy, but when I mentioned that I was rewatching Fargo, everyone comes back and says, oh, you mean the TV series? Series 4 has just started. It's amazing. Should people go from the film Fargo and watch the TV show?
I don't want to cause too much controversy here, but I am ardently opposed to Fargo, the TV show, which I consider a misunderstanding and perversion of everything the Coen brothers stand for. I think that you see certain elements of their style, their fondness of symbolism, of chance and coincidence, used in these really bludgeoning, obvious ways that the Coen brothers would never permit. I find this to be a cheap knockoff of the Genuine article.
Yeah, I think I watched the first season, which had Martin Freeman, and is essentially like a retread of the film, but lost interest after that. I was basically watching it thinking I could just be watching Fargo and it's 97 minutes or whatever it is, and, you know.
Yes, I'm of the same opinion. When it's a TV show that goes on for a long, many seasons, or watch a 97-minute film, I will choose that every time. But listeners, your mileage may vary. Let us know if the TV series of Fargo is worth watching, and let us know what you think of any of the films we've discussed on the episode today at the usual channels. That's at LWLies on Twitter or via email at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. So next week we have a prepositional double bill. We have Ben Wheatley's In the Earth, followed by Lin-Manuel Miranda's In the Heights. And in Film Club, because Monster Hunter is out in cinemas, we're going to give Paul W.S. Anderson his due. We're going to be talking about, well, let's say, David Jenkins' highlight of the Resident Evil franchise, Resident Evil Retribution. Let us know what you think of any of those films, if you've seen them already, at the usual channels, and subscribe wherever you pod. If your podcast player of choice also lets you leave a review, we'd love if you left one for us too. Adam, Charles, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been such a pleasure. And listeners, thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.